بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله وحبيبه أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد، اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد، وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، ولعنة أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى يوم الدين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Brothers and sisters, so we are coming down to the wire right now. We're coming close to the end of Ramadan. Most likely, Eid will be on Wednesday. So this is our last chance. Allah is all merciful. Those things that we would have liked to do that we have not done, for example, Sila Rahim, for example, you know, doing that night prayer that we always wanted to do in Ramadan, this is the time to do it, inshallah. Continuing our discussion on the verse of Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas ta'muruna bil ma'rufatan wa tanhauna 'anil munkar wa tu'minuna billah, as the guideline for the superiority, if one could use that word, the superiority of our community. Allah has said that we are the best nation or the best community He made for mankind, with the condition that we enjoin the right and forbid the wrong. And this enjoining the right and forbidding the wrong is what we would probably put into the realm of tabligh. And we see that tabligh is not just simply trying to bring people into Islam. Tabligh is also being a reformer in the community that you live in. That's tabligh as well. And so now we are going to, we were talking about tabligh by word, by the tongue. I want to mention the other aspect of tabligh, which is tabligh in action. And there's a hadith by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam where he says, Kunu du'atan linnas bil khair bighayr al-sinatikum liyaraw minkum al-ijtihad wa sidq wal wara. He says, invite people to what is good with other than your tongues, so that they see tenacity, veracity, and piety in you. And wara is a kind of a piety. It's not like taqwa. Wara is basically something like abstemiousness, you know, where you actually outwardly avoid certain things, and you know, you do only good things and so forth on a conscious basis. What I'd like to mention is some aspects of those things, because we're talking about akhlaq here, right? We're talking about akhlaq. And akhlaq is a pretty wide subject. We can't cover every aspect of akhlaq here, but we know that akhlaq definitely is the means whereby a person reconstructs their character. This is what akhlaq is, right? It comes from khulq, and khulq means character. It means personality. Akhlaq is making that word khulq into a transitive verb, having an object, which means working on the self to perfect one's character, working on the self to perfect one's personality. This is akhlaq, you know, and definitely somebody with good akhlaq speaks volumes to others just by how they are, you know. I have a friend, for example, who was telling me he was on a long flight. I can't exactly remember where, maybe between Iran and Canada. He was on a very long flight, and because he's a Muslim, he ordered a special meal. And you know, when you order a special meal, sometimes your meal comes before everybody else's. So the host, the steward, brought the meal for him, and he sat there with the meal, and he didn't open the meal. He didn't open it, right? He sat there right there waiting until the meals came for the other people. And the man sitting next to him asked him, well, why didn't you start eating when your meal came? It might be much colder now. He said, because in our religion, it is not polite, it is not generous to eat in the presence of somebody who's not eating. You know, so I waited for you to bring, for your food to be brought, then I would start. This is akhlaq. This is teaching people by example. Okay? This is akhlaq in practice. This is tabligh in practice. You know, you do something good. I remember the last university I went to, I joined the African Caribbean Students Association there. You know, when you're going around the first day, you know, they introduce yourself and so on. And they asked me, well, you know, who are you? And I said, well, my name is Ahmed Hanif, and I'm a Muslim, you know, and so everything I do is Islam. That's all I said. Didn't speak another word about Islam to them, unless they asked me to. But when they look at your behavior, you know, and what they see that they like, they say, well, oh, this is Islam. I like Islam, you see. Some people, you know, vibe or feel an affinity much more to you when you do not put a label on it, especially in this environment of Islamophobia, okay, irreligiosity, actually. You know, as soon as you put a religious title on it, as soon as you put a label on it, they don't like it. They turn away from it. You don't put a label on it, they like you very much. You know, when they realize that you are acting based upon that label, based upon that label of being a Muslim, what sets up in their mind is what you call in psychology a cognitive dissonance. This is what is set up in the mind of a person, a cognitive dissonance. A cognitive dissonance, there are different explanations and applications of it, but a cognitive dissonance is, for example, you dislike something, and then you get an experience of that thing that is pleasurable, that you like very much. And so it sets up a dissonance, a lack of harmony between how you felt about that thing originally and how you feel about that thing right now. And this sets in motion a weakening of that previous state. That is if the good state came afterwards. Sometimes it could be reversed. Sometimes, you know, a person could be really interested in Islam, you know, very, very, very interested in Islam, and then have a series of negative experiences with Muslims. You know, so there's a cognitive dissonance here. You know, and what might happen is their interest in Islam could be weakened. Okay, so it can go both ways. So this is a tabligh. Tabligh is something, is very, very psychological, actually. So I want to mention some akhlaqi things that are in consonance with what we are talking about. We can't talk about all of them, but we can talk of some of them. And it all deals with a community situation. Right? Remember, as I told you, one very, very important step in tabligh is being able to invite the people or person you're working with or you're talking to your gatherings, to your community, be it your home, be it your center, be it among your friends that you're going to go out and into a restaurant, you know, bring them into that environment. You see, when you enter an environment, now you could become, you can see this belief playing out in front of you. And this would help to strengthen that desire to become part of that community. Remember, we live in a society that is dysfunctional. There are a lot of dysfunctional people in this society. You know, there are people who are not friendly because they had very cruel parents, for example, and so on. You know, and so there are people who are actually thirsting for a healthy relationship and a healthy community, and this is where we come in. So one of the one example of akhlaq that I'd like to mention is about brotherhood. It's about brotherhood, because when that was one of my first experiences of Islam in a community situation, in a community setting. I was among a lot of Muslim brothers, as a non-Muslim, that I was privileged to share their company, you know? And sharing the company was very, very impressive, you know? Very impressive. And this was like in the you know, late 70s, for example, you know? So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Al-mu'min ahul mu'min, ahul mu'min. The mu'min is the brother of the mu'min, or the believer is the brother of another believer. Aynahu wa daliluhu, his eye and his guide. Wala yadlimuhu, and he does not betray him, he does not oppress him. Wala yaghushuhu, nor does he wrong him. Wala ya'idduhu iddatan fayakhlifahu, and he does not deceive him or go back on a promise he made to him. So a Muslim, a brother of a Muslim, has these different characteristics. Okay, they do not, that person is their eye and their dalil, their eye and their guide. Eye meaning your brother knows your flaws better than you sometimes. My eyes, for example, is not outside my head to look at me. He would look at me from the outside from an objective point of view and see my flaws in my own independent behavior, see my flaws with respect to other people, you know, and they tell you about it. That's a good brother. They tell you about it. You know, they're not shy to tell you about it, but they will tell you about it in a soft and kind way. And they are your dalil. They are your guide. They're the ones who could tell you, for example, if you do X, it's not a good idea. If you do Y, it's a good idea, because they know you very well. There's a hadith that says, you know, brothers are not always from the same parents, for example. You can have brothers who are brothers in faith, and it could be much deeper than brothers who are the from the same parent. That person does not wrong him, does not do dhulm on that brother, does not deceive that brother, and does not go back on a promise that they make to this brother. That these types of characteristics lead to a much more solid type of relationship with each other. So brotherhood is something that is very important to preserve and to carry out with each other. Now, nobody is a natural brother. I mean, we do make friends in our community that we have a natural affinity to each other. That is true. But this is on a much more minority type of a level. When we say being a brother to somebody, it means making an effort. It means doing those things that brothers do, what Islam says brothers do, and staying away from those things that Islam says that is not characteristic of brothers. So for example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he also says, if you want your brother's love for you, there are certain things you must not do with respect to your brother. Don't make fun of him, for example. Don't quarrel with him. Don't brag with him. Don't exchange bragging with him. And don't compete with him in evil. These are the things that you don't do with a brother. And you find that, for example, among people who are close friends here in this country and in the United States and in Canada and in France and everywhere you go, you'll find that there are some quote-unquote brothers that do this. For example, you know, in a lot of communities, people use swear words to refer to their friends, their close friends. They use swear words all the time, you know. Sometimes, and I've seen this, fighting breaking out because it becomes ambiguous whether the swear word that you used to address your friend or your brother was one that was in the lighthearted way that you usually do, or you actually was insulting him. You see? So among Muslim brothers, we wouldn't do that. You know, for example, in my community, based upon rapping, for example, the N-word has become a sort of a word of endearment and empowerment and so forth and so on. But it is an insult, okay? And what happens is other people pick up on that and will tend to want to use it on you, you see? So you have to be really careful about this. And rap music is, I'm not against rap music, don't get me wrong, because in the 1970s and 80s, the major means of Islamization of African Americans in the ghetto was rap music. And rap music was not at that time music that you danced to. It wasn't dance music as such. You know, it was music made by the people in impoverished parts of the country where they did not have the money to buy instruments, and so they would mix records, you know, and scratch them and so forth to come up with interesting sounds. But most importantly, the lyrics, the words that they used were words that were critical of the society, words that supported rising up against oppression, and it was very heavily influenced by Muslims. So rap music in the 70s and 80s was music that was the most important medium for people to become Muslim. All right, I've seen that myself. But today, for example, you have rap music where, you know, people, where DJs diss each other all the time. You know what diss means, right? You know what to diss somebody means? Disrespect, right? Or yeah, dismiss. In other words, you know, I'm the baddest, I'm the best, I'm the this, you're nothing, that type of a thing, right? And these types of things play out on the street, you know. When guys play basketball, for example, you know, the side that is winning, this is the side that is not winning, and sometimes basketball can turn out to be a bloody conflict, right? You know, so this is what it's like, what the imam is saying. When you're with your brother, for example, you don't make fun of him. You don't quarrel with him. When you quarrel with your brother, what happens is you become angry. And when you become angry, you are very liable to say things that you will regret. You're very liable to say things that you will regret. You're very liable to say things that will destroy a relationship completely. And there'll be no other means of coming back and restoring that relationship. You know, and I'm sure many of us have gone through that. I have had experiences of that. You know, so we have to be very careful about controlling our temper. So you don't quarrel with a brother. You know, instead you just stand down, you stay low, and maybe bring somebody else to sort of like discuss with him on your behalf. This is how you deal with brothers. You know, you don't brag with him. You know, I did this, my kid did this, your kid didn't do that, and so forth and so on. These things create jealousy. These things create insecurity and negative feelings in the mind of people. And don't compete with him with evil acts. And this is another thing that you find among really good friends in this society. They compete in doing evil acts. They compete in, for example, the consumption of drugs. They compete in, for example, their attachment to music. They compete in all kinds of things. All right? You know, what this does, it actually destroys the relationship. It destroys the relationship because the relationship now becomes based upon something that is false and something that is wrong. So when somebody enters that type of environment where you have a healthy type of brotherhood, what do they feel? They feel as if they're on vacation. They feel as if they're on vacation. Because their soul utters a sigh of relief. Ah. And they always want to come back. They always want to come back. So you might not have a whole lot of talk. You might not have a whole lot of, you know, information to give them about Islam and so forth and so on. You just bring them in the community. You just bring them among the friends that you have, provided that you become aware of the criteria of brotherhood, for example. And that person would want to be part of this. Why do a lot of kids join gangs? Why do a lot of kids join gangs? If you look at the makeup of gangs, you would notice that the majority of kids who are in gangs are from broken homes. are from broken homes, are from homes where they have never seen their father, or if they saw their father, they saw him very infrequently. You know, homes where, for example, they were an orphan in that home because their parents didn't want them. Okay? This is what you meet in gangs. Okay? You know, why do they join gangs? They join gangs because they want that love. They actually want that love that they did not get at home. I'm going to say something, and it might sound kind of controversial, all right? You know, but you had this rapper, Tupac. Okay, I'm not too much in favor of a lot of his songs, but sometimes he hits the nail on the head in terms of his social criticism. And he said, a gang showed a young brother love. A gang showed a young brother love. And that's why people join gangs, because gangs, they find belonging. They find belonging. It is in a gang they first knew how to hug another guy and feel loved by him without feeling gay. It's in a gang they knew this. Okay, because you have some fathers who don't hug their sons. All right? So people are looking for alternatives. And unfortunately, the alternative that they might find is an alternative that is dysfunctional, that is, illegal. And so we have to open ourselves to bringing that type of person among ourselves, because they want to be rehabilitated. You know, I've seen, for example, in a lot of different centers, they're very, very queasy about providing services for youth that have been in prison, you know, youth that have been locked up in youth homes and that type of thing. They're very queasy about it because we have a middle-class type of a mentality, us Muslims at large and us Shias in particular. We have a middle-class mentality. You know, we do not like lower-class people, what we call lower-class people, coming among us. You see? And if you look at the story of the prophets and so on, you know, the majority of people who become Muslim, who embrace religion, are the oppressed, are the people who are slaves, are the people who are prisoners, etc., etc. These are the people who embrace Islam, not the rich, not the arrogant. And so we have to find a way for them. But first of all, we have to be able to do something for our kids. You know, there are very few communities that are doing a lot for their kids. I mean, the Koja community is doing some excellent work with their kids. You just go up to Stanmore and you can see it happening in front of your eyes. You know, but for us, we don't do much. Now, doing something for teenagers and people between their teens and their 20s is not just having Sunday school classes and talking. It's not about just that. You know, youth want to be active. Remember, we were talking about the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam when he was in his 20s, you know, and he was a member of the Hilful Fudul. You know, and he said this was the best experience of his youth, because these guys used to go out there and look to see if people were being wronged and try to fix the situation. And youth need to do that, especially young men. They need to do that. They need to have an active role or an active part in trying to change their environment. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with having a healthy Muslim gang. You know, not one that preys on society, but one that helps society. And they do this on the basis of futuwa, Islamic chivalry. You know, futuwa, which is translated in English as chivalry. You know what chivalry is, right? Chivalry is being always ready to put yourself on the line to help other people. That's chivalry. You know, being always ready to put your life on the line to help other people. And the best fatwa was Imam Ali alayhi salam as a youth. And from this word, we get the word futuwa, where the knights of Islam, the soldiers of Islam, the horse riders of Islam, for example, would display great courage for the truth, for that which is right. You see, the word futuwa comes from youth. It comes from youth. You know, and if you want to see what the ideal youth should be, you look and see what Imam Ali alayhi salam, as a youth, used to do. And so there's nothing wrong with having a youth corps, for example, where they are the ones to support Amr Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar. That is something that would grasp them, not just brothers, but sisters too. You know, and just for good measure, you know, have a place like this, you know, where you could work out your kung fu, learn some kung fu or karate or something like that. So, you know, nobody could mess with you. All right? So if somebody slaps you in the face, you could give them the other cheek because you know you could destroy him, but you choose not to. Oh, yes. It's one thing to get slapped on the other cheek when you know you can't destroy that person. This is why, for example, we have a big issue with Christians when they talk about turning the other cheek. We see turning the other cheek means nothing if you have no power to stop that person from slapping you on the other side of your face. What does it mean? It means nothing. The only time it means something is when you have power over him, okay, or you know you have power over him, and you forgive him for what he does. This is what forgiveness means. This is what turning the other cheek means. And there are people out there who are haters. As I mentioned time and time again, the flag bearers of Islam, the flag bearers in our community are not the men with the longest beards. The flag bearers in our community are the women with the hijab. That's the flag bearer in our community. And they're the ones who are harassed. They're the ones who are in the front, the war front between Islam and Islamophobia. Look at all of us brothers here. You know, apart from the ones who are wearing dashdashas and outwardly Islamic clothing, all of us, when we go on that street, we can just disappear in a moment. You know, you look no different from the other people on the street. But a sister with hijab, she looks different. And haters will go after her. So she is the flag bearer. She is the Abbas in our community. And usually the flag bearer is the one, okay, who could fight. Isn't it so? The flag bearer is the one who could fight. Because if any time you attack the flag bearer and the flag falls down, everybody becomes demoralized. When you look at a stranger, when they come into this society, a Muslim who comes into this society for the first time, they're surprised there are so many Muslims in London. Why? How do they know there are so many Muslims in London? Because everywhere they look, they see hijabis. Everybody they look, they see hijabis. So if we do not train our daughters, to ideologically defend Islam and to defend themselves if attacked, we are disempowering the flag bearer. We're disempowering the flag bearer. That flag bearer will fold that flag up when you're not looking and go outside and try to mingle just like you. We tend to treat our daughters as if, like, you know, Bulugh is just sort of like a rite of passage. Okay, my dear daughter, you're baligh now and you should wear hijab and go to school. And that's the end of that. That is ill-preparing a daughter to be able to deal with the outside world. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his family. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, there are different types of brotherhood. There are different levels of brotherhood. Okay, there's one level of brotherhood here is I and you. You're all my brothers. It's true. All right? But I don't know which of you is untrustworthy. I don't know which of you I could trust with my money. I don't know which of you I can trust with my secrets. You're all my brothers. I stand up for you. But then, there's a guy I went with on Hajj. And we really clicked. That's a different story. Or there's somebody I was working on a project with. And I got to know him really well. That's another story. So what we have to try to do is to create situations and scenarios where we find ourselves working together for a common good. Out of that, we would emerge a true and a deeper brotherhood. And it's that type of brotherhood, not this general type of brotherhood. It's that type of brotherhood that would bring people to Islam. It is that type of love and familiarity and trust and joy that will bring people to Islam. Inshallah, may Allah give us that insight. May Allah give us the opportunity to be able to do that. May Allah give us the opportunity to come together and be one with each other. And inshallah, he will give us tawfiq. Salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.